I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois. This is Positive Leadership, the podcast that helps you grow as an individual, a leader, and ultimately as a global citizen. Organization culture involves behaviors, attitudes, values, and written rules that influence employees' behavior within an organization. It impacts your performance and that of everyone around you. Culture, in short, is a big deal. My guest today, Dr. Mary Murphy, is a social psychologist at both Stanford and Indiana University. In her new book, Cultures of Growth, she shows how to create and sustain a growth mindset in any organization's culture. It is a must read for business leaders, educators, coaches, and anyone who wants to improve the performance and satisfaction of the people in their team. It was such an honor and pleasure to have Mary on the show. This episode is packed with practical tips and tools to help you steer teams and organizations towards embodying a real growth mindset. First, I'd love to step back a bit in time and ask you about your background, where you grew up. You are born and raised in San Antonio, Texas. And what were the values that shaped you? What was the influence as well, maybe of parents, sometimes grandparents as well? Mm-hmm. And where does your interest in psychology come from?
So I grew up bicultural in a working class family in San Antonio, as you say. My mom's family comes from Mexico, and my dad's family is Irish and German, hence Mary Murphy. and I grew up the eldest of three kids. And I think that being the oldest, if anyone else can relate to being the oldest, you know, there's a certain way of growing up. My family had high standards, right, for the first kid and a lot of attention in that way. And I really grew up in a family of teachers. My mom was an elementary school teacher, my maternal grandmother, my maternal grandfather, my aunt. And so I kind of grew up in this culture, this family culture that was obsessed with learning. And as a little girl, I remember I would play school with my stuffed animals where I'd line them all up. I'd have a whiteboard in front of me and I would be there teaching them lessons from the summer, you know, workbook that we would get to take home. I was, you know, a real wild child. and I'd say, you know, those influences that really focused on learning and, you know, a love for that really helped shape me over time. My interest in psychology, I think, came from growing up bicultural, noticing how we shift our behavior in different cultural contexts. When I'm around my Hispanic family, you know, there's a different way of acting and interacting with each other that's different from, you know, when I was with my dad's family. And I also had the experience of going to an all-girls Catholic high school. And I feel like there you really see the differences, right? Where you're surrounded just by women and what that does, the kind of relaxed nature of that that happens. And then when you're after school and suddenly the boys come into the, you know, place, you're suddenly acting differently. And so noticing how we shift that behavior, that was really, I think, the impetus for psychology. I never really thought of it as a serious discipline and then lucked into some psychology classes. And there it grew from that point.
Okay, so basically you were born to become a teacher, right?
I think I was.
Of teachers, and you're born not only to learn how to teach, but certainly how to learn, by the way. Because I think there's always this interesting perspective between the art of teaching and the art of learning. We had a great episode on that topic with Sal Khan and of course, his academy, where he's, as you know, doing great work on that, on both sides of the equation, actually. We'll come back to that a bit later. Yeah. So it's been almost, I think, 20 years, Mary, that Carol Dweck's published her seminal book, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, which coined the terms growth mindset and the fixed mindset. And bearing in mind, some of our listeners may not be familiar with the work. In a fixed mindset, talent and intelligence are viewed as predetermined traits, while in the growth mindset, talent and intelligence can be nurtured, can grow. I must disclose that I read Carol Dweck's book in 2016, as well as asked to drive a major transformation of the global sales organization Microsoft to morph from a software company to become a cloud and AI first company. And at the time, we realized globally and executive level of the company, that we need to evolve our culture to be less aggressive, less competitive internally, and more innovative, more customer obsessed, and more growth oriented externally. So this is the reason why fundamentally we embrace the concept of growth mindset for all of our people, now about 220,000 people, and what it means for each one of us and for our company as a whole. So I'm really excited to have you today, Mary, to talk about all the work you've done to study across the world, different types of organizations, the way you actually nurture the culture of growth. So, but we start to start with Carol Dweck's book. To what extent it has really transformed our idea of individual potential?
Well, JP, I can't think of another idea that has been more transformative when it comes to thinking about individual potential. I mean, this work, there have been so many studies, thousands of studies at this point, some with children, some with adults, you know, in all different kinds of contexts. And what we see over and over again is that, you know, these mindsets predict almost everything about our motivation and our behavior, but especially in times of uncertainty and change, right? Everything is changing at the moment so rapidly, we can barely keep up with it. And that's when mindset is likely to have its strongest impact. So we know from decades of work that mindset shapes the extent to which we feel fear failure. So, you know, if we think that you either have it or you don't, you're in this fixed mindset kind of belief, you have to always show that you have the talent, the intelligence, the ability, the capabilities. And so you kind of worry about failure. You worry about mistakes. In fact, we see in the research that you hide mistakes. One of my favorite studies is with six-year-olds that Carol did early in her career. And she found that kids would, if you left a answer sheet to the questions that they were supposed to be asking out, you know, if kids had been primed to move towards their fixed mindset, they were more likely to cheat. Feel, you know, when the experimenter left the room, quote unquote, accidentally left the answer sheet, right? Because they wanted to show that they were smart and capable and competent. And you have a lot of, you know, compassion for what that is. And I think that we see that in adults as well. We see the extent to which you're willing to exert effort because we believe that if you have to try hard, it means that maybe you don't have the natural skills or abilities, right, that the fixed mindset says you need to have. And again, whether we relish or whether we shy away from challenges, all of these things really are fundamentally shaped by whether we are in our fixed or our growth mindset at any given point.
Yeah, and I love it. We'll come back to that later as well, Mary, when it comes to also this, not this concept, but actually this challenge that we ask to all of us, to ourselves. If you need to work that hard, it means that probably you're not smart enough. And it means you probably, and I think that's a big inhibitor, I think, for many people.
It's a huge barrier. It's a huge barrier. And it's one of the most popular triggers, the mindset triggers that move people toward their fixed mindset is those high effort situations. When I'm having to master a new area or domain, I get a new job title, I get a new set of work that I have to sort of now work on, and it doesn't necessarily come naturally to me. We see a lot of people will actually, you know, decline these kinds of opportunities, stretch assignments and others, because they're worried that if they have to really double down in terms of their effort, they're going to be seen as not having that natural talent and ability.
We'll come back to the other observation you had during your research as well, the so-called triggers as well. Now, let's come back again to the work you've been doing with Carol Dweck, because she's often described, as your mentor.
Yes.
Basically. In her book, she talks about our mindset continuum, again, that ranges from a fixed mindset, where individuals, again, believe their abilities, intelligence are static and unchangeable, to a growth mindset, where they believe these qualities can be developed through effort, learning, and persistence. In your work, you've expanded the concept from the person to the team and all the way to a broad anti-organization. So how did you come to the idea that mindset does not live exclusively within the individual, within ourselves? And how did Carol react to your observation, your concept about broadening out the idea of mindset, right, to the broader world in many ways?
That's right. That's right. Well, it started around 2004, 2005. Carol had moved from Columbia University to Stanford University, where I was a PhD student. And what happens in the PhD program at Stanford, it's the number one psychology program in the country. So, you know, it's a kind of a tough program to get into, yeah. High standards. And what happens every year is that the PhD students give a talk to their local faculty members in their area. And I was in one of these talks supporting one of my friends who was in his fourth year of the PhD, really speaking about his life's work in this presentation. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the presentation, without raising their hand, on the right-hand side of the room, a professor just blurts out, "Well, it's clear the fatal flaw is XYZ." And we all kind of look at once and we said, "What's going on? What is this?" And then it's silent. And then on the left-hand side, a professor shouts out, "No, the fatal flaw isn't XYZ, it's ABC." And they start talking at each other. And I would say the right word is talking at each other, not listening, not kind of understanding, but fighting amongst themselves to see who's the smartest in the room, who could take down the student's idea the quickest with the most fatal, you know, identity of the problem. And I saw what it was doing to my friend up there. You know, he withdrew. He wasn't able to answer questions. He was stumbling, even though he was the expert on his own work. This is something he'd been working on for years. And I also was struck by what it did to him, not just in that moment. He was able to finally go ahead and finish the talk. But what happened to him over months, he was unwilling to go back and revise and touch that work again because that experience had been so painful.
Yeah.
So 2 weeks later, I'm in a different seminar, different set of faculty, and they're completely different in the way that they approach these student talks. They're still finding all of the issues and the problems with the work that's being done. But instead of actually competing on who can take down the ideas and find the fatal flaws, they're now competing on who can figure out the best solution to improve the work the most. And so they're saying things like, "Oh, the student should include this new measure or work with this different population." And I saw the students, what were they doing? They are able to participate in the brainstorm, answer questions, and they left motivated to apply those ideas right away because they had strategies from that conversation that they could apply right away. And who made the most progress over time in the program? It was the students in the Culture of Growth seminar, not the Culture of Genius, the Fixed-Minded seminar. So I was thinking about this for a while and you know, I wasn't that familiar with the idea of mindset. Carol had just arrived to Stanford. But I kept thinking back to this and I said, these are two different ways of motivating people, right? These two different contexts. And one is a very proven perform. You're only as good as your last performance. You're going to sink or swim. And the other is much more focused on learning and development. So I take this over to Carol and I knock on her door and I say, Carol, I know everyone has been thinking about mindset sort of as a quality of our own minds, our individual mindset. What's your mindset? How does it affect you? What's my mindset? How does it affect me? But has anyone ever thought about mindset as a quality of a group, of a team, of a whole organization, right? Of a school or a classroom, and how that mindset culture might affect the people within it? And then I told her the story of what I had observed, and she looked at me for a moment. She blinked a couple times, and in her Carol way, was kind of quiet for a moment, and then said, "You know, Mare, no one's ever thought of mindset that way, but it makes a lot of sense to me and we should do it together." And so that began 15 years of research that we have now done together to look at mindset culture and how it affects us.
15 years of research.
That's right. Pretty amazing.
Before we move on, I just want to pick up on what Mary said there, because it really captures what I've seen in my own professional life. Ironically, cultures of genius produce less genius. When everyone is in prove and perform mode, people compete to show that they are the smartest one in the room. And others just self-censor because they are worried they are not. And both of these behaviors are ultimately damaging when what you need is for people to be suggesting great, innovative, and creative ideas. While people within strong cultures of genius are in fighting and watching their backs, those in strong cultures of growth are getting ahead together. Cultures of growth look to how they can help people continually grow and develop, understanding that when this happens, they are more likely to innovate, use data and tech-informed risks to work cooperatively and as a direct follow-on to achieve better results.
You know, a lot of times leaders will come to me and say, I'm just not getting great ideas from my team members. Nobody is really suggesting anything innovative or creative or new. And then I say, well, what's the mindset culture we've set up here? Is it a safe environment to really voice new ideas and creative things, things that may, there might be mistakes along the way or things that might fail, right? If we have these senior folks always vying for the smartest in the room award, nobody's going to, like you say, suggest or provide even their best ideas because they're worried others are going to steal them, for example.
Absolutely. So let's get back to your research work because I think it's really interesting to dig into it and to get some of the facts that you reveal of this work. Can you tell us more about the scope of your research projects? I think you did a lot. How much diverse organization did you study between the largest multinationals in the world, maybe startups, entrepreneurs, maybe even public services schools? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about the way you've been studying that diversity? Mm-hmm. And what did you find out across the diversity as well?
Yeah. So, you know, we have been looking at how these mindset cultures are created, how they are sustained and maintained, mm-hmm. and then what we need to do to actually shift them. And so those three aspects are things that we have looked at, as you say, in very large multinational companies. We've worked with Shell. We've worked with, mm-hmm. with many technology companies. It won't surprise you, given the lead of Microsoft. All these tech companies are interested in mindset culture. We've also worked with hundreds of startup founders and early stage organizations, Series A, sort of seed organizations, and looking at how the early mindset of the founder is going to impact the way that they set up the organization, the initial culture that they set up, and then how that impacts who they bring on, how they build their organization, and how ultimately they're successful with regards to fundraising and their goals and market share ultimately of their organization. So we've studied those kinds of questions. And then in schools, we have looked at this everywhere from kindergarten through 12th grade, and then also in higher education. We've looked at how the mindset of college instructors, for example, shapes the practices that they engage in their teaching, how that is perceived by students, and how that influences students' motivation, engagement, their sense of belonging, and ultimately their performance over time. And so we can measure these things. In a lot of organizations, what we'll do is we'll go in and we'll do a measurement across the organization, usually taking advantage of some pulse survey or other thing that organizations have. And then we'll create sort of a hotspot, bright spot analysis. We'll be able to see the places, usually, especially in very large organizations, there might be an overarching mindset culture, but there's going to be many microcultures.
Many pockets of cultures.
That's right. Microcultures that can, you know, you might have a very strong culture of genius, but in the R&D section of the company, that might be a very strong culture of growth where they're prototyping constantly, right? Making mistakes all the time, learning from those mistakes rapidly, innovating, right? And so really understanding the hot and bright spots within an organization then help us say, okay, here's the DNA of where a culture of growth can thrive and what are the practices we can learn from that and then apply them, maybe not wholesale, but certainly adopt them to other parts of the organization, right? A lot of times that is very much more interesting to companies to have the local DNA and to see that these cultures of growth can thrive in our own environments here in the organization than, you know, the Microsoft case study, for example, where people are saying, well, we're not Microsoft, right? And they can think of all the reasons why what worked there might not work there here, right?
Yeah,
and yet you show them that it is working in some pockets in their own organization and then how to grow it. So I do think that that has been very useful as we work to change culture.
Thank you. Super insightful to see you again. The way, as you said, you can detect the nuances of your mindset and culture as an organization.
That's right.
And the way you can actually replicate some of the best practices and the way you can evolve gradually across an entire organization, which I know is a lot of work. So let's get into the core concept of the book, if you don't mind, Mary.
Sure.
Because in your wonderful book, Cultures of Growth, you talk about how you assess whether a company is predominantly a culture of growth or genius, and how others can work out whether the organization sits on a mindset continuum with cultures of genius and cultures of growth being at either hand of the spectrum. So can you ground us on the concept of culture of genius versus the culture of growth? And also then later on, the misconception, I think, that is very visible between the culture and a mindset, which I think are two very different animals.
Yes, yes, you're right about that. So, you know, to get us all on the same page about these concepts, you know, sometimes people, I always say it's the litmus test as to whether people have read the book, because genius sounds so great. Everyone wants to be a genius. And so when people say, oh, I love that culture of genius, I say, I'm not sure you've read that book.
Reread it.
That's right. That's right. So what I mean when I call it a culture of genius, this is a term I coined in 2010 with one of our first papers on this area, where it really is a fixed mindset culture. Yeah. It's focused primarily on star performers, and it has that fixed mindset idea. You either have it or you don't. Talent, intelligence, ability. It's basically fixed, static. There's not much you can do about it. And so therefore, in these teams and organizations, even in families that have strong cultures of growth or genius, they're going to basically focus on the stars in those contexts, believing that these people are inherently more capable due to some kind of superior intelligence or ability.
Yeah.
And conversely, the culture of growth has that growth mindset as the core of its kind of belief and ideas. And it believes that if given the right supports, everyone can develop and contribute. And the reality is that just like with our own personal mindsets, it's not that you have one or the other, right? All the time, right? This is the irony of the way we've thought about fixed and growth mindset is that nobody wants to have the fixed mindset and everybody wants to have the growth mindset. and that we can't even talk about the fixed mindset. Mm. But the truth is that we all have both within us. And when it comes to organizations and teams, many times we see that teams and organizations are a mixture of a culture of genius and a culture of growth. And there are going to be different times when we are embodying with different practices, more of that growth mindset idea, and sometimes more of that fixed mindset idea. So it exists on a continuum, just like our personal mindset exists on a continuum. I would say to your second question around some of the misconceptions, I would say the first one is that false dichotomy idea that you either have one or the other and there's nothing you can do about it. The mindset culture continuum is a real thing, and we have seen, you know, shifts. And it's really important for people to understand that, because culture is not something that's ever complete or done. If we stop paying attention to culture, we will see a backsliding of that culture to what, say, the industry's culture, the dominant industry, or the dominant society's culture might be. And so always thinking about how we can shift along that mindset culture continuum is really important. The second misconception, I would say, is that mindset is all in your mind. if you have a certain mindset, that's who you are. But what we know is clearly now, after these 15 years of work, that our mindset is really greatly influenced by our environment and the people around us. And then finally, the third misconception is really that mindset is just all about effort. If we try hard, right, that's all we need to do. But what we have learned over time is that brute force effort, if we just keep banging our head against the wall over and over and over again, right, it's not the wall that breaks, right? It's going to be our head. And so a true growth mindset and a true growth mindset culture is going to be one that really focuses on effective effort. Is the effort that we're putting in actually moving us towards our goal? Do we need to change and adapt strategies? Do we need to pivot, right? And being able to understand and learn along the way so that we're making those pivots sooner, and so that we know that the effort that we're expending is actually moving us towards growth and development and towards our goals. And so in true cultures of growth, we see a lot of support for this kind of learning, these structures for learning, and then also a lot of strategies to help people be able to learn, grow, and develop.
No, super clear. Super clear, I think, in terms of the core, again, concept. You know, something you said that really resonates well with me in culture. In my 40 years kind of professional experience now at Microsoft, I've seen a lot of changes, obviously, like any large company. But I would say you test your culture in a few different moments of your professional life, organizational life. One is when things don't go well at all. when you've got big failures.
Yes.
Personal failure, collective failure, enterprise failure. Mm-hmm. And the way people, including, of course, leadership, reacts to that.
Yes.
And what, and the way they behave in that moment.
Yes.
The world they use, the message they send, the way they get back to the entire teams on what does it mean and what accountability, whose accountability is that as well. Another experience I had as well for many years now is the way we try really hard every day to live our values, as we said. And, you know, many companies have defined a set of core values. Mm-hmm. At least they sound great on a slide and sometimes on a poster on a hall. But it's so hard to actually have even a strong alignment on the meaning of the word and a value. Mm-hmm. You know, taking a couple of words we had at Microsoft, respect, integrity, accountability. Mm-hmm. I can assure you that the discussion you can have with many other people in that world could be so diverse mm-hmm. in terms of the understanding. And then when you bring that into the context of what they do, this is, I think, when you really can observe the culture in action.
Absolutely. I think you're exactly right. It's in those moments of trial and in those moments of failure that you're going to see the strongest cues, for lack of a better word, to what the culture, the true culture is. And people are particularly going to be tuned to their leaders and to their managers to say, you know, what is it that we truly believe? What is it that we truly value here in the moment?
So now I'd like you to play like a consulting role with me, Mary, if you're okay with that. No, because, you know, this Positive Leadership podcast is also all about practical tips, tool set yes. that people, listeners can use. So let's play with two kind of role and personas, right?
Okay.
My first role, I'm the manager of a team of 10 people. I'm excited about my job and our team charter, but I find it very hard to get my team to take risks, to innovate and accelerate our growth. What should I do differently, Mary, to change the behaviors and the norms of my team?
Very good question. Very good question. So, JP leader, I would say, you know, it sounds counterintuitive, but I think one of the best ways to lean into our growth mindset as a leader and then with our team is to actually acknowledge and learn to work with our fixed mindset. So recognizing, is there some barrier that is really triggering the fixed mindset and making it such that people are not willing to contribute new ideas or to think yeah. creatively or to brainstorm yep. With each other, to be a little vulnerable in raising potential ideas, right? So recognizing that all of us, you know, for all mm-hmm. of us to embody our growth mindset, we also are going to embody our fixed mindset some of the time. And so yep. what I say is start to learn your own mindset triggers as a leader and then start to voice over what they are for people when you find yourself in a fixed mindset triggering situation for yourself. Maybe yeah. your team is asked to take on an incredible challenge in a very short timeline, and this is really triggering you to the fixed mindset. We got to be perfect. There's no room for mistakes, right? Oh, this yeah. kind of belief. And just saying that, you know, I recognize that this is my default, and I really want us to push against that when it comes to yeah. this particular project. Let's try to occupy our growth mindset more here. The other thing that I have teams do, especially small teams, like a group of 10,
yeah.
is to go and take the mindset trigger assessment and then to talk with each other as a team, given that you're going to be in interaction with each other over and over yes. again and working on many different projects, to really be able to understand and have the conversation around when different individuals are likely to be triggered to their fixed mindset. We know that, for example, praise and the success of others is a big mindset mm-hmm. trigger. And so if I was the leader, if you're the leader of the group of mm-hmm. 10, and you know that three or four of those individuals are really triggered when you praise another individual that's not them,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Makes them feel that if that person's the star, maybe there's no room for me. You uh-huh. might praise people differently on the team,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And so you can take behaviors and do things differently, knowing what the various mindset triggers are in the room around you. And that will help you create that microculture of growth within your team that's going to produce that innovation and risk-taking and better performance that we know is possible.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. It's great, great, great set of advice. I mean, particularly I love the what you said, celebrating others' success.
Yes.
Meaning not just my success as an individual or as a team manager, but actually the success of other people. And in a way, you could contribute to their success, which is even better,
making
others successful. And in return, I think as they see that, I think, and I've seen that in action, actually, it's not just a concept in my mind.
Yes.
They will start playing the same way. They will start as well contributing to your success.
That's right.
To the success of the group. So they see the dynamic collaboratively, then it's going to really trigger a very interesting positive circle of innovation. Now, let's imagine that startup company has grown tremendously and I'm now the leader of a company, right, with 1,000 people. And I've got a team of teams, which is I'm leading, you know, basically 10 leaders and themselves a bunch of organizations. So what would you advise me to do as a leader of this much broader, larger organization beyond what you said, which I think makes a lot of sense, but, you know, being kind of the team of the teams, leader of leaders, is it kind of a different scale as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, I do think it's a different scale. And I have worked with a lot of CEOs and their executive teams that then lead different functions within the business and different parts of an organization. And what I would say is that we usually actually start with a lot of self-reflection from these leaders around where they have seen themselves embody the fixed and growth mindset. What are the stories? You know, one of the most powerful cues around a culture in an organization are the stories that leaders tell about their own experience and their own struggles and their own journey. And it's very telling when leaders never speak about their own struggles and their own journey.
Failures.
And that sort of thing.
Yes.
That's right. And so we talk about this and we sort of, the leaders themselves develop their own mindset story around where they saw themselves embodying the fixed mindset, how it held them back, and how they were able to shift. What were the strategies? Who were the people that really helped them shift towards their growth mindset? How did that actually help them in their careers over the course of their time to become leaders? Where do they see their own teams kind of defaulting to the fixed mindset? And as they start to have that kind of conversation, then what we do is we have those leaders start the process within their own verticals, within their own teams, and start to have the conversation with their leadership. Then we start this conversation. It's important to have similar language so that, you know, when you have that shared language, then it's easier to point to some of the behaviors and some of the beliefs that we see kind of popping up. And then we look at processes. We look at the practices that are routine and ordinary in the way that we start meetings, in the way we lead meetings, in the way we learn, the way that we give projects and promotions and evaluation. So we look at these different aspects that are really important because they materially affect the people who are working in an organization. And that's another big place where we're going to see the mindset culture in action. And when people say, what is the true mindset culture of your team? Is it what we say? Is it the values that are written on the wall, as you say, or on the website? Or is it how we actually treat each other on a day-to-day basis, what we say and do on the ground? And, you know, academically, there's a big controversy and sort of question as to which one is truly culture. I would argue it's mostly what matters on the ground, at least to workers. That's what they're going to be contending with on a day-to-day basis. And when you ask them what the mindset is, that's what they're going to refer to. We've seen that in the data over and over. So attending to those kinds of practices is really the work of leaders, and helping to create this kind of mindset story across the team is essential.
What Mary's saying makes a lot of sense. As leaders, we need to be purposeful about creating growth mindset culture and self-aware when we are driving core management processes like hiring people or praising others. Also, telling someone good job, great work, help them feel good, which is great, it doesn't tell them what they did well and what they could build on. It doesn't tell anyone else on the team why they could actually develop over time. So, when you're giving praise, try and be specific and consider whether you are praising just the outcome or the process, the how. Be mindful that you're highlighting and giving awards to people who improve the distance traveled. Rather than just praising the people that they are at the very top of the heap, that is communicating whether we really focus a little bit more towards the culture of genius or a culture of growth. Well, I'd like you, Mary, to tell us, what is the Q's audit? You mentioned the Q's a few times. This is actually a tool that you've been developing. Can you tell us more about the way it works and the kind of triggers as well that you've been picking to make an assessment of a team or organization?
So we have been developing tools and using them in our research for the last 10 years or so, both at the individual level and then at the structural or group level. And so at the individual level, we have the mindset triggers, and that's something that individuals can take for themselves. They can also take it if they have a relationship, a close relationship with someone, a mentoring relationship, or you can take it thinking about your kids, right? Thinking about their mindset triggers. And you can identify then, what are these four different situations that we know from the literature kind of repeatedly move people between their fixed and their growth mindset on an individual basis?
Yes.
So that is the mindset triggers assessment. Mm-hmm. And then there is a cues audit, because we know that these mindset cultures are really signaled through the situational cues and cultural artifacts that surround us. We can, like being a good sociologist or a social psychologist in my case, right? Looking at the environment and seeing where we might be, maybe even unintentionally, communicating more of these fixed-minded beliefs, this culture of genius, in our everyday processes.
Yes.
So
yes.
What does it look like in this Q's audit? The Q's audit is also an abbreviated version, also available on the website for the book. And so people can take this in teams, and leaders can take it. But it asks you to really look carefully at the environment. Things like analyzing, you know, we have taken AI tools and scraped the websites and mission statements of the Fortune 1000. And then we look at data sets like Glassdoor and others to look at how the mindset culture that companies are externally communicating to society, to potential workers, to others, how that actually is related to people's experiences on the inside of the company.
Reality.
So looking at that website and the mission statements, we look at job ads as one of the cues that's going to tell you early on if you are a potential employee looking for jobs. You can often tell in the job ads themselves, given certain language, whether this is more a culture of genius or a culture of growth. We also look at application and interview questions. Interview questions are very telling, right? That's one cue as to what matters here. Are we going to be asking questions about the challenges you encountered and the strategies that you used in the past to overcome them, knowing that that distance traveled is going to predict your distance going forward? Or are we just asking about the successes and the opportunities that you were able to bring into the organization, not asking about the team that you developed, just you solely as an individual, right? The lone genius. And then looking at performance evaluation and promotion processes, what actually counts on the ground? What data are we collecting? Again, is it focused just on outcome? Is it also focused on process? We will also look at leaders' messages and practices, team interactions, how we start and end meetings, how we discuss mistakes, what structures, if any, are in place for learning and for sharing that learning broadly across teams in an organization. And then finally, with leaders and managers, we'll do a Q's audit to look at how they build learning processes into their strategic work that they're doing, how they actually support measured and informed risk-taking, how they give feedback, right? Those sorts of cues are the kinds of cues that matter to people on the ground and that are going to signal the organization and the team's microcultures and macrocultures of growth or genius.
Super helpful, Mary. Super helpful. And again, we'll make sure we'll post your website on the podcast summary to so the listeners can take that Q's audit as well.
Sure.
You know, one of the big drawbacks to having a culture of genius at organization is negative impact on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Mm-hmm. This, I think, spurs you onto Fund Equity Accelerator, which is a resource for companies and schools to help them shift their focus from addressing diversity from a culture of genius to a culture of growth organization. So can you explain the correlation you found, I think, with a culture of genius and lack or not enough diversity and retention as well in organizations? And what help do you offer companies and schools with your equity accelerator?
Great, great question. So this link between mindset, culture, and diversity and inclusion is something that we had been studying for probably 5 or 6 years now. And what we find over and over in organizations and companies, large and small, and as well as in school settings, is that when we think about a culture of genius, we have a prototype in our society about who those geniuses are, right? If I were to put in genius into a Google image search and I was able to see what the images are, who do you think I would see, JP?
Einstein.
Einstein. You'd see so many Einsteins. Einstein everywhere.
Yes.
You might also see whom? Do you know?
Not sure will be the second one.
Sometimes it's like Newton. Sometimes it's Steve Jobs. Sometimes
Steve
it's
Jobs,
even
yeah,
like Elon Musk occasionally comes up, right?
Really?
So okay. We have some of these prototypes, yeah, right? That's what these Google image kind of generators actually show, is what is most closely associated with these ideas. And so these prototypes implicitly and subtly influence in a culture of genius who we are going to look for. In a culture of genius, you want to be surrounded by other geniuses. That's who you're going to look for hiring. Yep. It's also going to be looking who you're going to be looking for promoting within an organization. And so what we see over and over is that those default culture prototypes of who a genius is, they tend to be white, they tend to be male, they tend to be of a certain educational and class background. And who does it leave out? It leaves out Black people, Latino people, Muslim people, people with any other difference, women, right? People with disabilities. Yeah. And so what we see in these organizations is that both on the recruiting side and on the retention side, because of they hit ceilings in these organizations where they're no longer seen as the prototypical genius or the likely genius who they want to invest in, the organization wants to invest in and grow and develop. And so what we see is that these organizations tend to be much more homogenous. And the culture of growth, it doesn't have that genius prototype at the heart of it. Instead, what matters most in a culture of growth is who can learn the most, who can improve the most, who can actually rise to challenges and overcome them in the past. And frankly, what we have seen from history and others is that a lot of minoritized individuals, right, women in some cases, in business settings, you know, have had struggles. And so in a culture of growth, you look at who has actually excelled when it comes to struggling and overcoming challenges. And those are the things that matter. And that's much less tied to a specific demographic in the way that genius is tied. And so you see a much more diverse kind of environment, both in terms of recruiting people, retaining people, and promoting people within these organizations and within schools. Who gets the attention? Who gets the benefit of gifted and talented programs, right? These sorts of things really accrue and are shaped by these cultural prototypes. And that creates diversity or homogeneity in these environments. So you're right. I created Equity Accelerator to really be able to think about how to apply a lot of this work in schools and in companies around the world. And Equity Accelerator is a focused research organization. We do three things. We do basic and applied research. We do tool development that takes all of this research and creates evidence-based tools, tests those tools with different real organizations and schools. And then we do technical assistance and consulting, where we will actually help people put in place these tools, measure change, and help support that change. And we've done this work in, you know, recently we just did 65 2- and 4-year colleges in the state of Texas, believe it or not, where we really focused on helping these schools identify the places where they could shift some of their practices with regard to student success to create these cultures of growth. We also did a massive study with over 300 STEM Gateway course instructors across 6 colleges and universities with over 30,000 students, where we helped those instructors use some of these tools to create more cultures of growth in their classroom. And then we studied how that affected students' experiences, their sense of belonging, their trust, their motivation, their engagement, whether they came to class or not for college. And then also we looked at their performance at the end of the term. And we found that when instructors were engaged with our tools, they were able to increase the motivation and engagement of all of the students and the performance, but they also closed equity gaps among racial ethnic minority students, as well as women in these STEM classes, as well as first generation students and low income students. And so we see the impact of that. In many contexts, we did a project with the OECD globally, looking at how teacher mindset and mindset practices of teachers shape test performance of students around the world. And in companies, we offer things like professional development, these measurement tools, and then bright spot, hotspot analysis to do this work.
No, I love it. I think, you know, just listening to you, Mary, it seems to me we have an opportunity to rethink the chief diversity officer job in a company.
Yes.
Maybe you should rename it as a chief cultural growth officer.
Yes, I love that.
No, because, I mean, what is not told about the diversity story in large organizations, and of course, many people work hard at that, is the basically the embedded piece of culture and the way you are actually taking action on the culture.
That's
before
right.
you set quotas, before you said, oh, I'm going to do this and that process. I'm not saying it's bad. You have to do that as well, probably. But if you don't change your culture, there's no way you're going to make a dent into diversity and inclusion. So
that's
love
right.
it. Now, let's continue to move forward. Another environmental mindset trigger you talk about in your book is evaluative situations. And I've had some great conversations myself about feedback with past guests. One of them, I'm sure you know well, Kim Cameron.
Who
talked to me about the reflected best self feedback, right? It's a wonderful episode, by the way, for the listeners who don't know Kim Cameron. In this model of feedback, the candidate and instructor collects and synthesizes feedback from people who've seen you at your very best in various spheres of your life, both professionally and personally. And this method allows the person being evaluated to develop a sense of their personal best in order to increase their future potential. So I know I want to build on that, Mary, because you've been somehow a bit provocative about focusing too much on strengths. You see me coming, right?
Yeah.
You said that the overfocus on strengths fails us. Can you elaborate on your position? More importantly, what a great critical feedback consists in?
Great. Great questions. You're hitting them all. So I would say, you know, strengths and strength finders is ubiquitous around the world. And I think my critique of it is that in a certain way of its implementation, which is that much of the time when we are talking about strengths finders or taking our strengths finders tests, what it shows us are the things that we are naturally good at, right? And then the advice that comes next, I think it's great to know what we actually are naturally good at and what we might need to actually grow or develop in, right? But what happens next usually when we deal with strengths finders outcomes is that people are told then, find the places that maximize your strengths. Move towards your strengths, right? And we talk nothing about what we could do to grow or develop in other areas. And I think that really, when you think about it, I can't think of a more clear culture of genius trigger, which says, do the thing that you're naturally good at and keep doing the thing you're naturally good at.
And ignore the rest. And just ignore the rest.
Everything else. Ignore and do everything you can to avoid all of the rest, right? And I think it can actually set us up for narrow boxes over time. Yes. You know, I see this also playing out in family dynamics where in a multi-child family, there'll be one child who is very creative, one child who is, quote, good at school, one child who is very good at sports, right? And we sort of think about these strengths of these children, and then we put them in more and more activities to build on those strengths more and more. And, you know, when they come to the limit of their capability or when they come to their limit of their interest, right, what are they left with? They haven't had practice growing or learning in a different area, right? Not being great at something. Michelle Obama tells a story about her two daughters and what she did for them when they were thinking about what kind of extracurricular activities to do. And she would say they got to choose one. Usually it was one that they were very good at, where they'd feel great and get all the positive praise. And I got to choose one as mom. Yeah. And it was oftentimes something that I knew they might struggle with a little bit because I knew that struggle and that development would be good for them. And who knows, maybe they would find an interest that they didn't know that they had. Right. Yes. So that's my issue with focusing too much on strengths. Well, what do you think about that?
it's a very important area of personal learning I had for so many years, Mary. I would say, you know, I've been not shifting, but I've been a lot more focusing on helping people first, building on their strengths. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important foundation to start with. Mm-hmm. But I would add, maybe, but also growing a few more strengths on the way.
Right.
That's the way I would paint it.
That's right.
You know, in the old kind of leadership model, I mean, many companies, many leaders say, okay, you get your strengths and you got your areas of development or weaknesses, you know, to say it publicly. and in a way, you know, we were spending a lot of time as well, maybe a lot more on the weaknesses or areas of development, which can be helpful. Mm-hmm. But if you overdo it as well, guess what? People fail their confidence, self-confidence in their strengths as well. So I think
it's a delicate
balance, right? It's
absolutely
not binary, black and white.
No, it is not. And, you know, in a true culture of growth, no one is going to have to really develop their weaknesses or the places that they really need to develop alone. They're going to have supports. They're going to have strategies. They're going to have feedback along the way. And, you know, it's only in those real strong sink or swim cultures that doing the development work is sort of an individual endeavor that will likely undermine people's confidence and self-efficacy going forward. You're exactly right.
So, Mary, I've got still a few more questions. Let's continue. It's exciting. You also talk a lot about the power of storytelling to cultivate deeper bonds and connection within a team. So, can you talk us through those actionable tips that can create positive ripple effects in organizations? And can you share any examples when you've seen that in action, again, in terms of that storytelling, creating deeper bonds, connect with the team? What does it work, concretely speaking, for organization? How do you make that working?
Mm-hmm. So I think that telling your own story of the places where, especially telling people's own journey in their career, their interests, how those changed over time, how, you know, the struggles that they had along the way, what are the strategies or the people that help support them? That becomes really important because it also models that there's going to be an expectation that when people struggle, they're not alone, that they're going to have others that they can come to rely on. We also have seen storytelling really important when it comes to both the successes and the failures historically of the team or of the organization. So telling the story, you know, there could be some lore in the organization of this incredible outcome that we had, right? When we moved from, you know, into cloud computing for the first time and we had this great success, right? And so how do we tell that story? Is it just about the success or is it about some of the, you know, mistakes along the way, what we learned from them, how we garnered that learning and actually led to the ultimate outcome of success that has been, you know, emblematic of what we are capable of in the organization. So, you know, those kinds of things, telling also the stories of big failures, because even though we don't want to speak of those failures often, I think people feel a little bit superstitious about speaking about failures. I think it's incredibly important to tell those stories and to figure out, you know, what are the practices, what are the structures we put in place so that those kinds of failures are ones that we're not going to be repeating because we have the learning that we were able to wrest from that failure and be able to communicate that broadly, right? And then also noticing what are the typical ways we fail, right? There's probably some pattern to the ways that we fail in the organization and being able to speak of those and recognize them, give them a name so that other teams can say, oh, we're falling into the old, you know, pattern of this kind of problem here. Let's be sure that we catch it and move away from it, right? So without that kind of language, it's very difficult for us to be able to learn and to not repeat the failures of the past.
No, super clear. You know, Mary, in your book, I was a bit surprised, but I think I understand probably why you didn't talk much at all, actually, about the generative AI revolution happening.
Yeah.
I think probably it's because you wrote it before ChatGPT even was
launched, right?
I guess that's the case. But now that ChatGPT, Copilot from Microsoft and other AI agents are available, I'd love to ask you the question, would you mind positioning the role of Gen AI, if any, at the individual level or organizational level when it comes to nurturing a culture of growth?
Yes, yes. So I have many thoughts on this now. And you're right. It did not exist when I wrote the book and when it had to go to press. But, you know, I have been thinking about the role of generative AI and how mindset intersects with it. I think at the individual level, growth mindset, we know, is essential for learning new things and to being open-minded as to how something can assist with learning and development. What are the strategies that are going to be most successful to really improve our learning and take it the furthest it can go? So at the individual level, I would say that having a growth mindset and inspiring a growth mindset will help people learn how to effectively interact and collaborate with generative AI. And that's really important as workers around the world are being asked and expected to be fluent in this new technology and to be able to harness it to better the work that they produce, right? So I think that's one thing, is having a growth mindset to really be able to meet the moment and the challenge of learning a new technology. I think a deeper intersection of mindset with generative AI is when it comes to thinking about how those generative AI platforms themselves will have a mindset culture baked into them. So, you know, in many apps and many platforms that have been created with generative AI at the heart of it, they're oftentimes used either in schools as tutors or in the workplace as a mentor. And so the question is, are those tutors and mentors, are they giving feedback and support in a fixed mindset way, really only celebrating success and outcomes, not really giving a lot of praise or support or points, for example, when it comes to trying new strategies, asking different questions, really showing the growth and the learning that has happened over time, giving people rewards for that? And so thinking about the different mindset cultures that the generative AI platforms themselves are embedding, and what, if they don't pay attention to that mindset culture, the default mindset culture is likely to be a culture of genius. This is the context, this is the platform that has the answers.
So, and again, people have to use it by themselves. That's always my big encouragement to people, as opposed just to read about it. But I would just point our listeners to the latest YouTube video that Sal Khan did with his son. Don't know if you saw it, where he was basically, Sal was prompting again, basically ChatGPT to be very, I would say, attentive, but also very supportive tutor to his son. And he told him, and his son was working on a math problem. I put in his resolution. Okay, what is that? How do you calculate that? And he told the tutor, don't solve the problem, my son. I want to give some nudges, some encouragements, but he's got to find a solution by himself. And then you see the dialogue between the, because the prompt of the AI tutor with the son, which was very interesting. So I think we might get there based also on the way we're going to prompt, we're going to interact with that AI.
That's right. And that shows too, like the importance of the prompter and their mindset, right? Because it really depends so highly, especially right now, on the prompting itself, right? Now, later, in different iterations, we might have this built in such a way that it kind of defaults towards growth. But right now, it really depends. And so if we come in with this fixed mindset, either get it right, get it wrong, you know, kind of area, we are going to be prompting in a way that's going to bring that out of the tool itself.
Yeah. So a couple of more questions, Mary.
Sure.
I'd like us to move to the world now. What I mean by that, you've worked with many organizations across the world, and I'm curious to understand how your research has factored in the cultural differences. As you may know, Erin Mayer, a professor at INSEAD, has developed the so-called culture map to help individuals and all of us understand and navigate cultural differences in the workplace. So, according to you, which key differences have you witnessed between countries' cultures as you've done your CUES audit as an example, to better understand the unique cultural triggers? And what would be your guidance, again, to a global leader listening to our podcast, or someone managing a bunch of countries from Asia to the US to Africa to Europe, everything in the world? How that leader should nurture growth mindset at a global level, transcending the national boundaries? How does it work?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, we've seen this both in our work, our global work with the OECD in education, but then we've also mm-hmm. seen it in the work Equity Accelerator has been doing around the world. And I will mm-hmm. say that the dominant cultural values do really shape the mindset culture of those local offices, organizations, yeah. businesses. Let me give you a specific example. So we were working with a couple of different organizations in East Asia. Mm-hmm. And we came and we gave some talks around what mindset culture is to some of the top yep. leaders in these organizations and what it isn't. And then we worked through some workshops on feedback and other processes. And then I was having dinner one evening with a CEO from one of these organizations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said to me, "It sounds to me like growth mindset culture is really a culture of feedback, where on a regular and routine basis, yeah. you're getting feedback of what you're doing well so you can build on those strengths and what you're doing poorly so you can adapt and pivot and try something new. And if you're not getting that feedback on a regular basis, right, if it becomes something that only happens quarterly or something that only happens annually, right, then it becomes laden with all this extra threat and tension, right? And people wonder and worry about it. It can move people right to their fixed mindset. Yep. So this has to be built in regularly. But he said here in East Asia, we don't give each other feedback very often because there is a face-saving honor system, right? Where we really want to give respect and deference to people who've been in the organization for a long time, especially people who are leaders in the organization, high in the hierarchy. And so very few early and new employees will not say, "I think that we are doing something wrong here. I think we could improve and do something differently or better," because it would be taken as an offense. It would be inappropriate from a cultural context to sort of do that. So how do you actually build a growth mindset culture and the practice of regular feedback in a way where it might kind of butt up against, at least on the surface, some of these deeper cultural norms? And so we work together to sort of think through how that could be done. And of course, there are lots of ways that feedback is given in East Asian cultures. It just doesn't look like what it looks like in the West. And so then, you know, how do we build in that kind of growth and development and that psychological safety so that people feel that they are okay to raise these things? And in fact, the leaders request them. And by seeing that the leaders actually have an expectation for some feedback, some ideas, and open up that space, then it provides an opportunity for people who are lower in the hierarchy to provide good ideas and to be able to raise the flag when they think something is going wrong or that could be improved. So these are some of the ways that we've seen the global context really shaping the way that you do mindset culture locally in schools and in organizations.
No, it makes a lot of sense to me as well, Marion. As I've been traveling the world for 35 years of my life, working across 110 countries, I can relate to that kind of culture of growth one country at a time. you cannot be confused about the world. Well, let me get into the last real few questions now. From what I've observed and heard from other business leaders and organizational psychologists for this podcast, Positive Leadership Podcast, it is clear that any significant shift or change in organization has to start with the senior leadership team. It's not enough, by the way, but it has to start there. When they demonstrate and model what is being called positive leadership, there's a positive ripple throughout the whole team. I often refer to the 9 pearls of positive leadership, which are effectively 9 lessons for leaders. And I've seen tremendous benefits to using this model of leadership. You start with you as an individual, being self-aware, growing your self-confidence, managing your positive energy in yourself so that you can build with others, make them grow, and eventually have a positive impact in the world together. So given your research as social psychologist, including this book, right, what would be your own definition of positive leadership? And what is a positive leader for you, Mary? If you use those so words.
So good. Well, I think my view of positive leadership is really leading with others. Not leading others, but leading with others and really taking responsibility as a culture creator. I believe that we are all, regardless of our roles, culture creators, but specifically leaders and the top leaders are outsized culture creators. And so taking responsibility for the mindset culture we create and what we say and do, seeing and truly believing in the growth and potential in everyone that we serve, including our employees and also our clients and our collaborators, and even our competitors, thinking about them in this way. And then also understanding that a positive leader is someone who's going to take responsibility for their own learning, growth, and development, and that's going to seek critical feedback and act on it. I think someone who really gives praise in this constructive, growth-minded way and gives people the tools and strategies that they need to fulfill their potential. So it's not just words, but it's actually actions and tools and strategies to help support people over time.
Super. So to me, one of the key, very last question, to me, one of the key outcomes of a positive leader is to deliver success, in particular by making others successful, back to the discussion we had before, right?
Yeah.
So Mary, to wrap up our conversation, I'd like to ask you, I guess, pretty hard and personal question. How do you define your own success in your own life, Mary?
That is a big question. I will say that I would never be an academic if I had to do academia and research alone. I have never published in the more than 100 articles and chapters I've written. I've never done anything completely on my own. I've always had a team of individuals.
Yes.
And I think that I measure my success in the teams that I've led, both in my academic life with undergraduate students, graduate students, research scientists, and then also in the professional world with Equity Accelerator. You know, success to me means really supporting other people. And what's helped me along the way is to build people first teams where we really believe in each other's potential and we're going to actively take measures every day to support each other's growth over time. That to me is success. And when I see people in my organization stepping up to challenges, when I see them pursuing growth opportunities, when I see them asking for new challenges, then that makes me feel like, wow, we've really created an environment here that I consider successful.
Wonderful. Well, Mary, it's been super insightful to have a discussion together and to get our listeners to get into the core substance of the culture of growth. We'll just summarize very briefly. I love the way you kind of frame the positive leadership. You've got to take responsibility for your own personal growth, number one. You need to be the culture creator. Mm-hmm. You need to lead with others, and you need to help them grow. With that, thank you so much, Mary. It's been a wonderful moment, and looking forward to your next books and next research, because I think we need to keep learning this culture of growth for sure.
Thank you, JP. This has been fantastic. Thank you for having me.
I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois. You've been listening to the Positive Leadership Podcast. If you've enjoyed the episode, then please do leave us a comment or a 5-star rating or share it with many friends. And make sure you subscribe so you can listen as soon as it comes out. Thanks so much for listening and goodbye.